You know, I did, because of our lesson this week on judgment, I put in a request earlier this week that the heat be turned on in this room. So we...
All right, so that's it for everybody? Okay, Todd, go ahead. All right. I don't care what y'all want to do.
Go ahead and turn to Isaiah 34.
Do what you can.
And I'll tell you too that
turn your hearing aids up.
Jeff and I did not coordinate on today's lesson. We didn't. You know how we're doing it here, right? We're just going. I didn't write Isaiah. I'm just reading it. We're just going. You know, chapter 34 comes after chapter 33. We did chapter 33 last week, so that's today. We're in chapter 34, and it just so happens to be very closely related to what Jeff preached on the first hour. In fact, let me draw a little diagram here for you. After I erase.
We're going to put the fan on that table so it will be higher up and maybe it hit
more off. Cooler. Air is cooler out there.
Dave, I told you to leave it there. I don't know why you wanted to move it over there. I'm telling you. Todd, I'm sorry. I told Dave to just leave it where it was. And you know.
Very cool. I might be very hot, David. Move the table. Yeah, move the table. I couldn't move because I think
they're
locking it.
That's good. Yeah.
It was me.
They want it where the air from outside comes. That's great.
Yeah.
Moving right along. Okay.
But it's Jeff. And it was very interesting to me because at the very end of his sermon, he did tie it together. I was thinking, oh, this is great because I'll just read 2 Peter in class. Well, he read it in the sermon, but he didn't. See, he talked about the flood, the destruction of the earth by the flood, and he said, but that's not just past, that's future. And then he read 2 Peter, how the earth is going to be destroyed by fire, but he missed something in the middle. No, I'm not faulting him. I mean, he only has so much time. I'm just saying that, aren't you so glad that you're here today? Because Peter, how does Peter know that? And I know I say that a few times, and I'm not discounting the fact that he's an inspired apostle who speaks God's words. But sometimes it's just a matter of him reading. He read Isaiah. Isaiah had already revealed that the earth had been destroyed by flood, but now it's going to be destroyed by fire. And so Peter is just saying the same thing as Isaiah, but he says it more briefly and in some words that are maybe easier. So probably most of us are familiar with what Jeff read in 2 Peter this morning, but fewer are probably familiar with what Isaiah 34 says. In fact, I thought if I'd run into Jeff and he said, what are you teaching on? Sometimes he asks, I'd say Isaiah 34. My guess is he doesn't have a clue what's in Isaiah 34, and you don't either, and I didn't last week. Well, you know, or not too long in the distant past anyway. But this is the very brief version. This is Peter just saying, we know this is going to happen. We know it because we've already, you know Isaiah. He assumes that his readers are familiar with that because it's given here at length. It's given here in depth. It's given here, in this passage, we're going to read it here in a second. You'll think, man, will he just not stop saying, it's not a real long chapter, but it's just kind of the same ideas. It's just like this relentless pounding hammer. In fact, I made one note here that one guy suggested that the intensity of the language in this chapter, it's a very discouraging chapter. We're talking about destruction and judgment. There's no happy things in this chapter, except insofar as judgment, the flip side of judgment is salvation, right? But it sounds very depressing, but the intensity of the language is used to produce an impression upon human hearts which are so hardened that plain language leaves them unmoved. So, go ahead and start discussing that. That's what we're going to see here in Isaiah 34. So if you have it open, it's not a long chapter. Maybe we'll split it into two readers. If somebody will take verses 1 through 7, who will volunteer to read verses 1 through 7? Cindy, and then verses 8 through the end. One more reader.
Sure.
Okay, Sharon. Go ahead.
Come here, you nations, and listen. Pay attention, you peoples. Let the earth hear and all the descendants of the earth and all that comes out of it. The Lord is angry with all nations. His wrath is upon all their own. He will totally destroy them. He will give them over to slaughter. Their slain will be thrown out. Their dead bodies will send up a stench. The mountains will be soaked with their blood. All the stars of the heavens will be dissolved in the sky, rolled up like a scroll. All the starry hosts will fall like withered leaves from the vine, like shriveled leaves from the fig tree. My sword has drunk its fill in the heavens. See, it descends in judgment on Edom. The people have totally destroyed. The people I have totally destroyed. The sword of the Lord is bathed in blood. It is covered with fat, the blood of lambs and goats, fat from the kidneys and rams. For the Lord has a sacrifice in Bozrah and a great slaughter in Edom. And the wild oxen will fall with them, the bull calves and the great bulls. Their land will be drenched with blood, and the dust will be soaked with fat.
For the Lord has a day of vengeance, a year of recompense for the cause of Zion. Its streams shall be turned into pitch, and its loose earth into brimstone, and its land shall become burning pitch. It shall not be quenched night or day, its smoke shall go up forever. From generation to generation it shall be desolate. None shall pass through it forever and ever. But pelican and hedgehog shall possess it, and owl and raven shall dwell in it. And he shall stretch over it the line of desolation and the plumb line of emptiness. Its nobles, there is no one there whom they may proclaim king, and all its princes shall be nothing. Thorns shall come up in its fortified towers, and nettles and thistles in its fortified cities. It shall also be a haunt of jackals and an abode of ostriches. The desert creature shall meet with the wolves. The hairy goat also shall cry to its kind. Yes, the night monster shall settle there and shall find herself a resting place. The tree snake shall make its nest and lay eggs there. It will hatch and gather them under its protection. Yes, the hawk shall be gathered there, every one with its kind. Seek from the book of the Lord and read. Not one of these will be missing. None will lack its mate. For his mouth has commanded, and his spirit has gathered them. He has cast a lot for them, and his hand has divided it to them by line. They shall possess it forever. From generation to generation they shall dwell in it.
Anybody need one to do the honors?
So, like I said, it's a pretty somber scene. It's kind of hard to outline a chapter like this because it's pretty much destruction. In fact, it starts talking about the nations in the first few verses, and then it's talking about Edom. But I'm going to argue, and basically everybody agrees, that there's really no change. I mean, it's Edom means nations, or more specifically, it means nations against God. So, if you want to say, well, the first part is judging the whole world, and the second part is judging only one nation, that's not true. That's not what it's saying. It's saying he's just pulling out one name to be representative, typical of all of them. So the outlines in the sacrifice here is really, it's just sacrificial language being used to describe their destruction. So, like I said, it's... it's more of a... he's got one idea, and he's just kind of going around and around and making it really clear that God's thought this through, and it's for sure going to happen, and that's what verse 16 says. Look in the scroll of the Lord and read. That's a little bit hard to know exactly, like, what scroll is that or what book is that, but the idea seems to be that whatever is going on, that it's certain. This is decided. This isn't like, maybe yes, maybe no, thinking about it. This will occur. Let's just look at the first section, as it were, the first part of the outline. And you have your outline too there on the front panel of your handout. The destruction of the nations. This is here where it's idea is introduced. Now, before I get into that, I should maybe back up and just say, do you remember the major? Well, you have it here. So, the major divisions of the book of Isaiah thus far that we've been looking at. You have the first 12 chapters. We spent a lot of time there, particularly as Isaiah developed the idea that yes, you're going to be judged, but there's going to be a king. His name is going to be Emmanuel. He's going to be a Prince of Peace. He's going to bring the remnant back. You're going to exile, but he's going to bring the remnant back. That's the first 12 chapters. And then in chapter 13, suddenly it's like a whole different book almost. Because now he's just talking about the nations. He starts with Babylon, and then he's talking about Moab, and he's talking about all these places. We kind of skipped over some of that because a lot of it's repetitive and difficult, and I didn't want to shrink the class size into, you know, a third. But that there is God's plan for the nations. He's sovereign over the nations. This part right here now, chapters 34 and 35, which go together. 34 and 35 are flip sides of one coin. There's no 35 without 34. There's no restoration, that's next week, without judgment today. God's going to purge the earth before he recreates it. He's going to remove the sin before he establishes righteousness. So 34 and 35, most everybody agrees, go together. The chapter divisions are... Right, Isaiah didn't write chapter divisions. So somebody added those later. Sometimes they're helpful and sometimes they're not. If you think like 34 and 35, well, they're different. Well, they're like I said, two sides of one coin. Well, these two together, chapters 34 and 35, are an end. Look at, just turn the page. Look at 36. Does it look different there? Radically different in tone and in topic. Now, we'll talk about that in a couple weeks. We'll get there. So I'm going to try to explain that it's not misplaced. I'm not saying that it doesn't belong there. I'm just saying that big shift in 36. So what that means is 34 and 30, and that goes through 30 through 39, by the way. 36 through 39 is all story. It's all narrative. It's all about Isaiah and his buddy King Hezekiah, and they're being attacked by the Assyrians, and that's what those four chapters are about. But 34-35, Isaiah brings the first half of the book to a climax, as it were, to a summary, and he's as it were, kind of tying up all the loose ends. He's bringing it all together. And more specifically, and I think I wrote this here, which point number did I write it? Major ideas on the second page. I said yes. Point number 6 is what I'm trying to explain right now. Chapter 34 really goes back to 13 to 23 and ties all those, you know, God had gone through nation one by one, boom, 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 and here's the wrap-up, as it were. 34 explains how the nations will be judged. Generally, ultimately, chapter 35 goes back, I didn't write that out there, but it's a little bit complicated because it looks back to 1 through 12, but it also looks forward. There's something of a hinge nature to 34-35. I don't know how much you know about this or how much you care, and I certainly don't care very much about scholarly views of Isaiah. Basically every, you know, non-believing scholar says there wasn't one Isaiah. There were two or three or sometimes more. So, because the one Isaiah, first Isaiah, who wrote chapters 1 through 39, he couldn't have written 40 and after. This is foundational view. I mean, you can't even talk about anything about Isaiah without believing that. And I reject it wholesale. I think it's a bunch of hooey. And here's one of the reasons. 35 is reaching into for it's a unified book. The threads that run through are connected, and one of the evidences for that. So what are they see that too, right? They're not they see the same things I do. So then what do they say? Well, they say, well, 35 must not have been written by the first Isaiah. It must have been written by the second Isaiah and stuck back in there. You can't win, right, with these guys. I mean, they're going to believe what they want to believe. But and for that reason, I don't spend a lot of time here talking about what the silliness they believe. But just make the point here that there are connections. And I know we're looking at this one chapter a week, and it's, you know, so spread out and a lot going on in between, but Isaiah didn't write chapters. He wrote a book. And so we want to see that whole message. And so 34 is really pulling together a lot that's gone before. And it's this very graphic description of judgment, right? It's talking about the slain are going to be thrown out. Their corpses are going to send up a stench. The mountains are soaked with blood. And that's a picture that, you know, it's pretty gross. And we're talking about, you know, real people. I mean, these are, you know, the inhabitants of China and Morocco and Texas. I mean, I think all of those are included here. These are the nations that are going to be judged. It doesn't say here why. Not right. I mean, there's a hint here. We'll get to it. But it just launches into God's angry with you, and here's what's going to happen to you. He doesn't describe their sin like, okay, we got, you know, you did this and this and this and this and this. He hasn't really done much of that in the whole book. Chapters 13 through 23 didn't really explain what they were guilty of either. I think they know. I think the nations know what they're guilty of. And he does say here too. In fact, let's just jump to that right now. Verse 8. This is the one explicit cause that is stated in this chapter for why he is judging the nations. Or it kind of, he says it flipped around. He says, I am going to take my revenge. Why? To uphold Zion's cause, right? Zion is Jerusalem, the capital of Judah and God's people. So God is doing this to protect his people. And you say, well, the flip side of that is that the nations, they're not protecting God's people. Rather, they are attacking, they are trying to destroy God's people. So God's going to intervene in order to deliver his people. Back to verse 4. Before I go to verse 1, go back to 5 through 7. God's going to punish the people, the nations who are arrayed against Israel, for that reason. But there's also something else that I think is implicit here, and that is, that is what's depicted here in the language of the sacrifice. God says the sword of the Lord, verse 6, is bathed in blood. It's covered with fat. This is very gory imagery of a sacrifice. The blood of lambs and goats, the fat from the kidneys of rams. By the way, the two parts of the animal that would belong to God was blood and fat, right? For the Lord has a sacrifice. This is a very big sacrifice. It's not just, you know, some goats and lambs, but it's also, verse 7, it's the oxen and the bulls and we don't know what all these words mean, but the bull calves and the great bulls, and the land is going to be drenched with blood. He isn't talking about an animal sacrifice here. Right? He's not talking about killing literal. He's talking about the people. The nations are the sacrifice. Right, that's clear from the verses that are right before and the verses right after. And I can push this a little bit further, and I have in the notes some things here. This is, again, implicit, but I believe the idea is the nations, the people of the nations, are their own sacrifice for sin. You can either have a substitute to die in your place. And if you don't have a substitute, then you die. And that's what's going on here. These nations have not accepted the grace of God. they've not accepted a substitute. Who, by the way, Isaiah is going to describe the substitute in chapter 53. Not only there, but especially in chapter 53, he talks about the one who took on the sin of the people, who's willing to take on, but you don't accept that. So, I think that's one of the ideas here, that the nations suffer judgment because they are guilty and nobody else has taken the punishment for them. As you know, part of me doesn't want to ask that question just because Isaiah's not answering it right here. And so I'm really, you know, so, and I know that can frustrate you because you want to like pull it out and you want to see all the, and I think kind of we spend so much time up here that I just want to be down at the root. But I think this is the end of the tribulation. But I'll have to split it up even there, because in Revelation, but only in Revelation, all we have tons of prophecy up until Revelation, but we don't know that in Revelation, in chapter 19, there's one judgment at the end of the tribulation. In chapter 20, there's another judgment at the end of the millennium. But I don't feel like I need to think about that necessarily in terms of what Isaiah is saying or what it even means for me today. But yeah, ultimately God is going to judge the nations. The fire that will not be quenched is described in Revelation 19. And I put a lot of references in one of these points here for you. Point number four. And I know you see a long list of references like that and you just go, yeah, long list of references. Next line. But there's some good things. Let me say the good. I mean, they're all sad things. I mean, it's good to me in this way, that just to see the consistency of this truth that keeps coming up again and again in Jesus' mouth. Jesus has read Isaiah, not only for that reason, but I mean, he knows that this day is coming when all men who have not all those who are not on God's side. I mean, that's how Isaiah would say it. You know? But how are you on God's side? Is, you know, we know today it's by accepting His Son and substitution for our sin. But so not only Jesus and Peter and Paul and Revelation, and it's a consistent theme throughout. This might be one of the lengthier treatments. You know, I'm a little bit, sometimes I read Revelation and you just think, man, it's just so short. You're like, no, tell me more. Well, here's the more. You just got to get into the bowels of Isaiah. And I honestly feel like this is the deepest part of Isaiah. I think we're kind of coming down into what the least known. More people know about the first part of Isaiah and the last part, but right in that middle, and certainly myself too, and until the last few months, going through chapters 24 through 35, but here's the toughest verse for me in the book, in the chapter, that is. Verse 4 is the hardest verse for me. I don't know why I draw your attention to it. Something I can't explain, except, and here's my problem. My problem is not that God can't uncreate all the stars. If he can make them in a passing comment on day 4 of the creation week, and he made the stars also. Remember that? Jeff pointed out. You know, and that was like from between 3 and 3:30 on that day he made the stars. And then, you know, he... that's not my problem. My problem is why. Why, if God is angry with the nations, and he's angry with the nations because they are arrayed against his people, why destroy the stars? Well, one answer... Well, I put a quote in here that'll help with giving you some of the options. It's in the middle of page 3. where it says V4, verse 4, gives a little explanation here, for four possibilities, or three possibilities of what the stars are. The word in the original doesn't say stars, it says a word hosts, which may be interpreted as stars. That's one of the possibilities. It may be that the stars are destroyed, that's choice A, or it may be, and I'm willing to go with this, I think that there's an idea here that I believe is true. It could be a reference to the destruction of the pagan gods that were represented by these heavenly hosts. Now here's an idea that I'm not prepared to get into, but I've been exposed to a little bit in recent years. But the idea that, maybe I'll get to in Daniel, there's some more, and I'm studying through the Bible as you know right now, and I'm going to get to Daniel in within a month, I think, I'll be in Daniel. I start Jeremiah this afternoon, by the way, where I am. Just finished Song of Solomon yesterday. But the idea of that demons, right, fallen angels, have control over certain parts of the earth, and they were connected in the ancient world with gods. Like so maybe, I mean, kind of my thinking, say before some years, was Edom had a god, Kos. He's never mentioned in the Bible, but their god Kos. And I just think he's nothing, right? Because the Bible says that, right? The false gods are nothing. But there might have been a demonic personality connected to that religion. So that's just sort of that's something I need to pursue a little bit more further. But if that's the case, that makes some sense out of verse 4. That God's not only, here'd be the point, God's not only going to destroy the enemies, his enemies on the earth, but also those in the heavens. And you can see how that would fit too with Revelation and God's defeat of Satan and the false beast and all of his armies. Right? The hosts, another word for hosts is armies. So God's defeating the heavenly armies arrayed against him. Okay. I didn't plan to say any of that. But now, we need to look at this. This is very important. We briefly touched on it before, but verse 5, it says, Edom. Judgment descends on Edom. So, and then later in verse 6, the Lord has a sacrifice in Bozra. Bozra is the capital of Edom. I'll draw you a map here real fast. Here's the Sea of Galilee. Here's the coast. Here's the Jordan River. Here's the Dead Sea. Jerusalem is right across from the northern end of the Dead Sea. This is Jerusalem. And down here is Edom. Southeast of the Dead Sea is Edom. And Bozra is the city here. So, geographically, you get your perspective. But why does he single out Edom? Because, too, when you read the whole chapter, it doesn't seem like he's talking... What's the point? I'm going to ask it this way. What's the point of God saying, I'm going to totally destroy Edom, and I'm going to make its citadels overrun by thorns, and there's going to be... its streams are going to be turned into pitch, and the smoke's going to rise forever. What's the point of doing all of that when Moab... still thriving, another enemy of God, or Assyria, or Egypt, or Babylon, or, right? I mean, it doesn't help a whole lot if we've just taken out one of the people. For this, and for other reasons, nearly everybody, I didn't read anybody who didn't agree, and those who I read, they all said, everybody says, so there's general agreement, that Edom, when you read Edom, think all, I don't want to say all nations, all enemies, all enemy nations. I mean, that's the point in choosing Edom, is because Edom is the sort of archetypal enemy. I mean, it'd be like, for America, it's Russia, Right? We all grew up, and Russia was the great enemy, the great Satan. No, that was what did Reagan call it?
Evil empire.
Yeah, the evil empire. And so, but I mean, today I don't know that it's quite so much, but and certainly not in the 90s. We kind of thought they were changing. I don't know if they changed as much as we thought they were going to. But in any case, you know, that would be like for us the archetypal enemy of America. Well, the representative enemy is Edom. Now, who is Edom? Edom is Esau, Jacob, and Esau. And from the very beginning, Esau is persecuting Jacob. Jacob's Israel. And not just the two of them, but then, and I put a couple of quotes in there to explain it in the notes, but I'll just make a couple of those points that really helped me. When Israel was coming out of Egypt, on their way to enter the promised land, Edom persecuted them. They're not even there yet, and Edom is already trying to hurt them. In Numbers 21. And then, at the end of the history of Israel, as it were, they come in about 1400. In 586, because of Israel's sin, God says, you're out of here. I'm taking you into exile. I'm bringing Babylon against you. Well, Edom decides to get in on the action. Psalm 137, verse 7, specifically says that Edom was attacking Jerusalem. And also the book of Obadiah. Now the date, Obadiah never tells us his date, so there's some difference of opinion. My present opinion is that Obadiah dates to that same time, 586. So in the whole book of Obadiah, now it's not a very long book, it's only one chapter, but the entirety is devoted to judgment on Edom. Why would you get a whole book? Just that's because they're representative of God's enemies, of those who have raised themselves up in pride against the purposes of God. And God says, I'm bringing you down. Okay, so point here, when it says Edom, think enemy of God's people. I was trying to think of a little acronym. This would be better for college students than for, you know, grown adults. But, you know, for EDOM, like enemy of God, but I couldn't quite get a... If you think of something, let me know, because I'll use it the rest of my life. But by the way, verse 8, the Lord has a day of vengeance. Flip over, can you do this, to Isaiah 61. See if this sounds familiar or not. Oh, this is such a good chapter. And you're going to... We're gonna get here. We're not gonna quit Isaiah before we get to 61. So you just be forewarned. You're thinking we're just gonna quit. We're not. But the Spirit of the Lord is on me, because the Lord has anointed me to preach good news to the poor. He has sent me to bind up the brokenhearted, to proclaim freedom for the captives, to release from darkness for the prisoners, to proclaim the year of the Lord's favor. This all sounds familiar because Jesus quoted it in Luke 4, and he said, this is about me. But then he stopped. The next verse says, and the day of vengeance of our God. Here's the point. There's one guy that Isaiah 61 is talking about. It's one person who is sent to do all of these things. Now, when Jesus was here the first time, he did part of that. Very, very partly. But he's going to finish his mission. He's going to do it all. He is going to proclaim the day of vengeance of our God. And let me make this point too. I think this is very helpful to understand. Not that you don't already, but the day of vengeance of our God, to comfort all who mourn. They go together. Vengeance of God's against God's enemies necessarily means relief for God's friends. It's those enemies who have been persecuting, punishing, destroying. Well, think of the sermon. Think of Noah, right? And we don't know. Genesis 6 doesn't tell us about the evil that the people did to Noah, right? I mean, Jeff kind of speculated a little bit there. That's all we can do. But you know, that I have, right, the Bible does say that they were very wicked. Noah's, the people around him were very wicked. That's why God was going to do such an awesome thing in destroying the earth by a flood. That wasn't just because, like, you know, they got a, you know, he was a little bit unhappy. They tipped the scales. So, okay, I don't know if I finished that thought or not, but I lost whatever it was. Questions?
Isaiah 63.
Yeah. Uh-huh. You're going to have to keep coming. I haven't got there yet. I don't know.
But it fits.
I know, it does.
And who's it speaking?
I know. I don't know yet. That's the honest answer. And I know that I've had that question come up to me a few different times, because I've stood with a group of about